This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. When Americans see, read, and hear stories from Iraq, they're usually unaware that behind the reporting of Western journalists are a cadre of Iraqis who've served as guides and translators for their stories. In the war zone, they're called fixers. Working at great personal risk, these Iraqis use their language skills and knowledge of local culture, politics, and religion to find sources for their Western colleagues and help them stay out of danger. Our guest Ayub Nouri served as a fixer for Western journalists in Iraq for 3 years. Over time, he played a greater role in reporting and eventually began filing stories under his own byline. Last summer, he came to the United States to attend the Columbia School of Journalism, and he recently wrote a story about his experiences for the New York Times Magazine. Well, Ayub Nouri, welcome to Fresh Air. You write in your piece in the New York Times, you were born in 1979 and grew up around war, the Iran-Iraq war in northern Iraq. You were in Turkey hoping to get to Europe or the United States when the American-led invasion was approaching in 2003, and you decided to return to Iraq. Why?
Because I thought the war would really end all the tragedies and hardships in my country. That's why I decided to go back. At that time, I was desperate for change. I was desperate to get rid of the regime that was in Iraq, because I lived all my life until 2003 under bombardment and war, and all the reason for all that was Saddam Hussein and his regime. So what I really hoped, and my only vision, was for a prosperous Iraq, a democratic Iraq, and a free country. It didn't cross my mind for a second what's happening now at that time.
You know, there's this term fixer, which refers to Iraqis who assisted foreign journalists, and we think of them as needing translation, but it really goes far beyond that. What did you and other fixers provide for journalists besides translating conversations?
Yes, but before that, I would like to say that to me and to, I think, all the fixers in Iraq, the word fixer was new. We knew what does the word fixer mean, because we all spoke English and we know that fixer is someone who fixes something. But the foreign journalists, especially the American journalists, were using the term fixer to describe us, and we thought we were translators, but they described us, or they referred to us as fixers. And what we did for them was we booked hotel rooms for them, we found sources for them to interview, then we oriented the American journalists about the history, the culture, the politics, and the society of Iraq, because we were all from there. At the same time, we sensed danger. We told them distances between the cities. And after each interview, we explained to them what the interviewee meant by certain points and certain terms. So we were not only translating. We were doing everything for them, and all they had to do was to write their story at the end of the day.
You know, in the early months of the occupation, Western journalists were able to move around in Baghdad and in Iraq much more freely than they were able to later when the security situation worsened. And during that time, I was wondering if you could sort of describe, if you can, what kinds of cues that you would pick up on the street that a Western journalist might not, about, I don't know, a checkpoint at an intersection by a militia, or the atmosphere at in a neighborhood or at a religious rally?
That's a good question, because survival as a reporter in a situation like Iraq or an environment like Iraq's merely depends on your precautions and your knowledge of the country. It is very important. I've survived until now by really taking precautions, knowing where I go, what would I say, what to dress, and how to behave and how to walk in the street. I have been in situations where somebody says a remark that smells danger, and I know if we spend more than half an hour or 15 minutes there, that he will provoke other people and there might be a mob. It is very important. I've even sensed the car bombs by analyzing the situation before that, and it has happened a few minutes later. So it is very important to see what people say and you talk to a number of people. It has happened many times. We were talking to a group of people, and other people were gathering around, and they were exchanging remarks among themselves and saying, what is this person doing here? What should we do about him or her? And in that situation, I would quickly warn the journalist to leave the area.
I'd like to return to something you said a moment ago, that there was one case where you actually sensed a danger of a car bomb, which turned out to be real. Describe what happened. What cues did you pick up that made you concerned about the potential of a car bomb?
This was just 2 days after the war started in March 2003, when reporters were traveling around in convoys most of the time, like five or six cars, and in each one of those cars there were two American journalists with their local driver and translator. And one day we were going to an area. I was sitting with two American journalists in the car and in the front seat with the driver, and they were sitting in the back seat. One of the cars in the convoy headed to an area that I knew really well, and the foreign journalist is with me. They told our driver to follow the convoy. And I got really upset. But before telling them that, I reached out for my helmet and my flak jacket. They were surprised. They said, you very rarely or never wear your flak jacket and helmet. How come you are doing that now? And then I angrily replied. I said, I'm sensing some danger. And that neighborhood that area where we go fell in the hands of some local fighters under U.S. bombardment. And those who were defeated might fight back today in retaliation. And I strongly advise you not to go there. But they didn't listen to me. They said, we have to go. Everybody else is going there. And I said, don't follow those drivers or foreign journalists. They are ignorant to the region, but I know. So they ignored my warning, and we went there. We got off the car, and we started to talk to some local people who were fleeing the area. And throughout the conversation and the translation, I was very nervous and angry. So about, I think, 10 minutes later, we got back into the car to leave. And the minute we got into the car with the writer, with the two American journalists, we started an argument. And we were in the middle of this conversation when we heard a really big bang. And it was a car bomb. It blew up exactly where we were 3 minutes ago, and it killed about 14 people. One of them was an Australian cameraman. He died instantly, as well as a number of local people. And then our own car was scratched by flying shrapnels. And that was one incident that I really sensed the danger and a car bomb. And it happened because of my knowledge of the area and by analyzing what had happened the day before.
You know, you said earlier also that there were sometimes things that you knew about the way you had to dress or the way you had to walk or carry yourself to ensure your safety. Can you give us an example of that?
Yes. For example, last time I was in Baghdad was April last year. I went to Baghdad and to the city of Kut. It is 2-hour drive south of the city, south of Baghdad, to do some reporting on the sectarian violence and the internal displacement, Shiite people being driven out of their neighborhoods and Sunnis the same way being driven out by Shia militia. I went there and the situation was really, really dangerous. I'm sure it is more dangerous now, but it was very tense at that time. And in Iraq, it's unlike many other places where a war is going on, because in Iraq, you don't know your enemy. Your enemy is everywhere. You might get caught up in a firefight between insurgents and the Iraqi police. You might get caught up in a firefight between American troops and insurgents, or you might be kidnapped by somebody for ransom, by somebody who doesn't like your religious sect or somebody who doesn't like your ethnicity. The danger is everywhere, and car bombs blow up every day, anywhere, unexpectedly. So I went there to do reporting, and I had my radio equipment, the recorder, all the cable, and the microphone, plus batteries, and a notebook. I cannot travel around with that bag on my shoulder, because I don't want to draw any attention. What if somebody wanted to look into my bag and see all of this? It's not common. They say, in a situation like this, what would you do? Why are you traveling with all of this? And that certainly puts my life at risk. So what did I do was, I put all the equipment I had was inside a bag, and then I would put the other bag, all the bag, inside a plastic bag to look like grocery, that as if I'm going shopping or I just came back from shopping. And before leaving my hotel room, I was carrying the plastic, putting everything in the plastic bag and going into the street. And I never took a taxi near my office or my hotel room. I was walking a few hundred meters away and then taking a taxi so that nobody knows where I was coming out from. And I didn't shave very often, like every 2 days. I did not wear very fancy shoes or iron shirt or any of these things, because it is very important not to draw attention and to keep as low key as possible in a situation like that.
You know, you said that you grew up around war because there was the long war between Iran and Iraq that you and your countrymen suffered through. And most of the Western journalists, of course, did not grow up with war, although many had experience covering other armed conflict. I wonder if you think growing up around war gave you a better sense of judgment, either a greater willingness to accept risk or a better judgment about prudently avoiding them.
I think it is a mixture of both, because I lost my fear of war after living almost all my life. After I was born, war started in Iraq until now. So I'm not afraid of war at all. And there has been times when one day I was with two American journalists and there was a firefight between two different groups, a Kurdish group and an Arab group near Tikrit, Saddam's hometown. And as they started the firefight, the American journalists, of course, they ran away and they hid behind a very high wall. But I was standing up and I was trying to see who's fighting who and what's going on. And they said, please, duck or try to hide, it's dangerous. I did not care, because that's how I lived all my life. When there was bombardment during Iran-Iraq war, I, my brothers and my family, everyone else in the neighborhood would go on the rooftop of the house to see which part of the city was being bombed. And sometimes the bombs were landing near our house, but we didn't care. In that situation, that's how I felt. I traveled around the country. I never cared about anything when I was on my own. But when I was with the American reporters, I had to care about them. I knew they were unfamiliar with a situation like that, and I had to really travel or behave as they wanted me to make sure they are safe.
Now, I have to understand this. I mean, you described a moment ago how when you were traveling in an area, you would be very careful to not appear conspicuous. Old shoes, you know, a day-old beard, your gear put in a plastic bag which could have looked like groceries, so as to avoid the risk of being identified and attacked. That, you were very careful to avoid risk. Then you describe a situation when two armed bodies are shooting AK-47 rounds whizzing through the air back and forth at one another, and you're willing to stand up in that case and try to identify the combatants and gather information, not so worried about being harmed. Why is the second situation less risky?
Because, as I described earlier, when you know your enemy, you are most of the time in a safe situation. Because when there's a firefight between two groups, you know who is firing upon who or who is shooting who. Then you know who is your enemy. You can, as a journalist, stay with this group. When I was wearing old shirt, a day-old beard, and hiding all of my equipment in a plastic bag, it was because I was in a situation that everything looked suspicious and I was surrounded by invisible enemies. I did not want to get really in trouble, and I had to take my own precautions. But in another situation, when there is a bombing or two groups fighting each other, you know how to take your precautions. It is very different when you know your enemy or when everything is clear before your eyes. No matter how intense is the firefight or the two groups fighting, you at least know the sides or where the fire is coming from. But in a situation like Baghdad these days, everything looks peaceful. You go out into the street, it's quiet, there are not people fighting each other every moment. But in an eye blink, there might be a car bomb. In a moment, somebody might pull up and kidnap you. The situation is very tense, and the enemy is invisible in Baghdad.
You spoke earlier about the stress that you felt being responsible for the safety of the journalists who worked with you and that other fixers felt, feeling that it was really up to them to keep their foreign journalists safe. And I wonder if you knew of situations where foreign journalists were harmed, but the fixers weren't, and they felt responsible or burdened or guilty because they had somehow not met that responsibility of keeping their journalists safe.
Foreign journalists have been killed along with their fixers, and in many other cases, the fixer has been hurt more than the foreign journalist. And I know an Iraqi woman who was working with an American journalist in Basra. They were both kidnapped in front of their hotel in 2005, and they interrogated them for a few hours. Then they let them go in the middle of the night. The kidnappers or the insurgents told the woman, the fixer was a woman and the American reporter was a man. They had told them to run away and promised that they wouldn't write about the kidnapping incident, but they had lied to them. The minute the fixer and the journalist had run away, they had opened fire. The insurgents had opened fire on them from behind and killed. The American journalist was killed right there, and the fixer was shot three times. She survived, and I speak to her. I've met her several times, and she is really regretful. She says that she wished she had died with him, or she wished she was the one who died and the American reporter would survive.
Do you know of many cases yourself where fixers who assisted American journalists were injured or harmed?
Of course. I know many fixers who have been kidnapped, and then most of the time those people who kidnap a journalist and a fixer, they might hate the fixer more because they say that if it were not for the fixer, a foreign journalist from America or from any other country would not be able to come to Iraq to travel around to do anything else. So they blame everything in that case on the fixer. And they hurt the fixer. They don't let him talk or to say anything. And they will blame everything on him for the journalist's presence in the country. And in cases, fixers have been hurt or being killed in Jill Carroll's case in Baghdad when she was kidnapped. They killed her fixer right there, and they took Jill Carroll for a couple of months. Then they released her. But the fixer was killed the first moment. They sometimes hate the fixer more than anybody else or more than the foreign reporter.
You know, earlier in our interview, you told us that when it was clear that the American invasion was coming, that you welcomed it as a chance to remove the horrors of the Saddam Hussein regime and bring a new day of prosperity and democracy to Iraq. Looking back on it, were you wrong or was the invasion mishandled? How do you look on that optimism now and the judgment that you made then?
Yes, I think I was wrong. At that time, I was only 24 years old. I did not have any experience in politics, or I did not have any experience in living in an occupied country, and I was desperate for change. But a country like America, the superpower of the world, with so many politicians from different political parties, Democrats and Republicans, so many universities and experts and scholars, things like that, they shouldn't have invested in my desperation or desperation of a number of Iraqis who wanted change. They should have thought about things and thought things over and analyzed the consequences of the war. I just wanted war at any cost, but if the Bush administration really had to listen to people and say what is going to happen, and I'm sure many people advised them not to go into war with Iraq, but they didn't listen. That's why I think I was wrong for being very optimistic about a post-war Iraq. And one other thing is that at this moment, I am not blaming everything on the Americans in Iraq. There is sectarian violence that the only responsible people are the Shiite and Sunni groups, the militia groups in Iraq, who are directly involved in the sectarian violence in killing people, in driving people out of their neighborhoods. And the political parties in Iraq who have formed the Iraqi government are also behind the sectarian violence, and they are not loyal to the cause of Iraq. The war made all the Iraqis know who's truly working for Iraq and who's not.
Well, Ayub Nuri, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Ayub Nuri lives in the United States, where he's completed studies at the Columbia School of Journalism. He hopes someday to return to Iraq and work as a journalist.